welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 529 for Wednesday, the 24th of May, 2017. My name is Harry Lloyd. Joining me on the show once again is Skylar Vicroy. It's been a bit of a tough week for everybody in racing, but we're here to remind everybody about the good times and hopefully do a little bit of justice to a true MotoGP legend, not just for having the medal, but also for how he acted. So this one is for you, Nikki. We also have a donation actually in honor of Nikki Hayden from John Thalmitz. You Motopod listeners really need some easier names to pronounce. Thalmitz, I think that's how you say that. For Nikki, and John donated $69 in honor of Nikki Hayden. So, thank you very much for that one, John. And thank you for everybody who has shared their thoughts on Nikki Hayden. Obviously the big news of the week was that unfortunately Nikki Hayden did succumb to his injuries from the cycling accident that happened a week ago. Unfortunately, pretty unbelievably, Nikki Hayden is no longer with us, which is, something I honestly never thought that I'd have to say, in my early 20s, which is, pretty grim. But he's obviously going to be hugely missed, and it's been pretty incredible to see the outpouring from everybody on, everybody from racers to famous people to just all of the fans of Nikki Hayden.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a tough thing to get read. No matter how many times I read any tributes to him or anything else, it's been this kind of shock and awe where, like you said, you don't believe it, because if, one of these guys goes out and crashes on the track, you're like, oh, it's terrible, but, part of the sport. But when it's away from the track and it's just the rug is pulled off from underneath you, it's, death is never easy to take, but it just seems a little bit harder when you never properly got to say goodbye. So it's definitely been a kind of an eye-opening thing to appreciate what we have in front of us, and we get to enjoy racing and stuff like this podcast. But it was definitely set the tone for the week, and I have to say it's a major kudos, because it seemed like this news was imminent, and he was going to succumb to his injuries because he was on life support. I was reading earlier that, I don't know how true this is, but his family wanted to wait until his family got there, but they also wanted to wait until the GP weekend had completed. That way there wasn't a distraction from the racing, and that Nikki could be honored by just having a good race and then continue. They can, honor him in later races. And I thought that was something that was pretty special, if that's true.
Yeah, that could have been the case. I'm not sure, certainly all of the Hayden family, lived and breathed motorcycle racing. Earl and Rose, his parents, they both raced, and then his sisters also raced at flat track, and then of course, both his brothers are fairly accomplished road racers, just like Nikki. Nikki Hayden, most people think that I watch a bit too much racing and that I'm a bit too obsessed with racing. But Nikki Hayden would literally watch any sort of racing under the sun. I mean, whenever you saw him and you got chatting to him, he'd watch the Northwest 200. He'd watched, some obscure dirt track event. He'd watched every class of BSB. Steve English, my co-commentator in World Superbikes, he was talking to Nikki, and Nikki was telling him how one day Nikki couldn't find a stream for Moto America. So Nikki FaceTimed Earl, his dad, and then got Earl to point the phone at the TV so that Nikki could watch Moto America. Jeez. Which is, no offense to him, but I don't, I can't see Jorge Lorenzo or Valentino Rossi doing something like that.
No.
Hayden was just a racer through and through, a racer on the track, and then a huge race fan off the track.
Yes. And so in tribute to Nikki, we're going to break format a little bit this week, and we're just going to share some stories that we all have of Nikki before we get into covering the Le Mans race. And I know Harry's got a few. I have a couple. And then I know Scott wants to talk. So we'll definitely get those plugged in. So without further ado, why don't you give us some good memories and stories there, Harry?
Yeah. So, first of all, I have to say that, probably without Nikki Hayden, that 2006 MotoGP season, I probably wouldn't be, sitting here doing a lot of the things that I'm doing, because, you know, that 2006 season for me, and I think for a lot of other people, you know, showed new fans what motorcycle racing was about. You know, I don't think since then there has been a championship that meant as much as that championship meant to Nicky Hayden. Certainly, you know, the outward display of emotion was, you know, something that we don't get to see a lot. And, you know, the ups and downs of that season, but how, you know, Hayden just kept going, kept pushing, is, you know, something truly commendable. And yeah, and, you know, of course, that last race in 2006, one of the most famous races there is, you know, not only with Hayden winning the title, with Bayless getting the W, but yeah, you know, that 2006 season is hugely influential, to the point where Nicky Hayden is one of only two riders I've ever stopped to get a photo with. The other one is John Hopkins. Both were at Jerez in, what year was it, like 2011, 2012, when Hopper replaced Bautista. But yeah, so, you know, Nicky Hayden was a pretty big idol for me. And, you know, Nicky Hayden was one of the few riders that whenever I had to go interview him for Dorna or now World Superbikes, that, you know, I still got a bit nervous about having to go ask him, you know, questions, and, you know, tried not to ask too stupid questions or anything like that. So, you know, I know that a lot of other people have also said this, but, you know, they say never meet your heroes. But I think for Nicky Hayden, that wasn't true. And that Nicky Hayden was, you know, he was a great guy on the bike, but an even better person off the bike. And, you know, I think it's incredible the outpouring that there has been for him. You know, every man and their dog has something nice to say about Nicky Hayden. You know, you have everybody, you know, posting photos, changing their photos to be the 69 and things like that. And, you know, I think it's testament to Nicky Hayden's character that, you know, if you take 10 people and you start chatting about racing to them, you know, most people have, you know, some bad views on, you know, this person, or they'll have some bad story. And, you know, that's with riders as well. You know, Jorge Lorenzo, you know, doesn't like Marc Marquez's riding style, you know, Valentino Rossi's a cheat, yada, yada, yada. You know, all the riders, you know, that, like, they get on, but, you know, there's little niggles against each of them. But not with Nicky Hayden. Nicky Hayden was the guy that, you know, people seemed almost happy to be beaten by. You know, his last few years in MotoGP weren't super competitive just because of the machinery. But, you know, when he got back on that factory Repsol Honda, you know, he was up there fighting for the top 10 before he crashed. So, you know, he proved that he still had it. So, yeah, I mean, Nicky's going to be sorely missed by a lot of people, I think. And of course he is, you know. And yeah, you know, he was just such a character, always happy to chat, as I said. You know, fortunately, my last memory of Nicky Hayden is, you know, as I said, getting to just chat to him about the Northwest 200 in Imola before we were having a staff meeting. And, you know, it was just... he was just being a normal dude, you know. That I think it was Freddie Spencer who said in an article that Nicky Hayden didn't change from when he was 12 years old to when he was 35 years old. And, you know, in that space, he won a MotoGP championship. And that changes a lot of people. But not Hayden, you know. He was always happy for a chat. You know, obviously, if he was in a bad mood, you know, he might not be super friendly. But, you know, that's all of us. And then, yeah, you know, there's just so many, you know, good stories about Hayden now floating around. Matt Oxley wrote a beautiful piece for MCN. Peter McLaren has a beautiful piece on Crash.net just about, you know, all the Nicky memories. I remember one of my first, air quotes, run-ins with Nicky Hayden was, I was like 14 years old or something, maybe 15. And I'd somehow managed to blag doing an interview for this Australian newspaper with Alex Briggs. And this is when Rossi was at Ducati, and I think it was like Brno or something. And I was sat in Valentino Rossi's chair interviewing Alex Briggs, and Nicky Hayden, you know, came into the Ducati pit box and gave me like the weirdest, like most confused look, and then just said, "You're not Rossi." And that was quite funny to, as I said, a 14, 15 year old Harry. But yeah, you know, Nicky was a true character. And, you know, as he said, Skylar still, you know, trying to come to terms with, you know, Nicky Hayden not going to go line up on that Donington World Superbike grid. You know, Nicky Hayden not going to be, you know, at the America's GP in 20 years, you know, waving and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's, you know, it is devastating. And, you know, I'm probably rambling a bit, but that's because, you know, it's very difficult you know, to express what not having Nicky Hayden around is going to mean. You know, he was, as we said, you know, the best of the good guys, and you know, was a true ambassador both on and off the bike for motorcycle racing. And you know, he was just, you know, he wasn't the Kentucky kid, you know, he was the Kentucky legend, as we said. So yeah, we're going to miss you, Nicky. That's for sure.
Those are great words there, Harry. That was well said, well thought out, and for someone that rambles, you sure do put stuff together quite well.
Thanks. I try. The getting paid to yell about motorbikes for a living sort of, you know, helps with the stringing together of ideas. But yeah, no, you know, and at both Donington World Superbike and at Mugello MotoGP, I'm sure that, you know, all of the paddocks will come together for Nicky Hayden, because, you know, as we said, there was no one who was critical of Nicky Hayden. You know, riders are critical of Mark Marquez's riding style. People are critical of, you know, Jorge Lorenzo's attitude. People are critical of Valentino Rossi. But, you know, nobody ever had a bad word to say about Nicky Hayden.
No. I, you know, much like you, I think without Nicky Hayden, I'm not here today. And I don't want to sound like a copycat, but it's very much true because, like I said, I followed his AMA career. When I started watching motorcycle racing, it was the Matt Mladen show. And he was kind of the first guy to come along when I came there to take Matt Mladen's crown from him. And Miguel Duhamel was also there. And you saw Nicky, you know, this guy that just looked like he's having a ton of fun on motorcycles. And then he wins the 2002 AMA Superbike, and then gets swept up to go over to MotoGP. And like I was saying on the last show, I didn't know what MotoGP was. I had no idea there was this humongous international, you know, racing circuit. I didn't even know that there was two-stroke racing, because we were, you know, all I'd grown up with was, you know, Kawasaki's and Ducati's around me. So, you know, so after a few years of following them in 2006, they're coming to Laguna, and I was in school in 2005, so I wasn't able to go when they first came. But the second year they came, me and my buddy, who were gotten into racing quite ferociously in that year, decided, hey, let's get together, let's go down to Laguna. And we, you know, got down there, and it was about the hottest year in Laguna I think there's ever been. I've been to about, I think, all of but three of the races there, and this one I can remember specifically because it actually got into the triple digits that weekend, which is unheard of on the coast here. And I remember how miserable it was, how hot it was in the stands. You didn't even want to drink any alcohol, you just wanted water because it was just so bad. And sitting out in the heat, and I remember I was so fresh into motorcycling, I didn't even know what a supermoto bike was. I was confused when the announcers were going on about it, and had talked about it, and I was, you know, I barely knew what dirt track was, and they were trying to give a history on Nicky Hayden, and I just was like, yeah, the road racer. And, you know, you go out and you watch this guy, and every corner he came around in the lead, it was just getting louder and louder and louder in the stands, and he won. And I remember at the time I had a brand new CBR. And I wanted to paint, you know, like his insignia and the numbers onto my bike right away, because I became such a fan. And, I got to see this race, and that's when it really took off. I started following his career in MotoGP and learning who Rossi was in the history and going back and, you know, getting my history up. And then I had a chance in 2011, because of the race teams that I worked on, I got better access and I was able to be on the grid. So I'm on the grid and I'm down there meeting people, and like I run into Ben Spies and I can take a picture with him. And then I catch out of the corner of my eye this guy dressed up like the Kool-Aid man, because, you know, Hayden was in his Ducati years and he's running around and he's at a brisk pace, but he's by himself. So I figure this is the time I need to go see if I can grab him for a picture. And so I tap him on the shoulder and I say, hey, Nicky, can I get a picture? And he kind of shoots me this face like he doesn't want to be bothered. And he just looks at me and goes, not right now, man, not right now. And I was like, oh, okay. So I stepped away, and I kind of thought to myself, like, man, this guy was, you know, didn't seem like he was doing anything, but he's kind of a dick. It's kind of a, you know, meet your heroes thing. So I was kind of bummed out, but then I learned that the reason why he was so upset at the time is there was a safety issue for the, at the time, AMA race. And he was trying to get the issue solved before he wanted his brothers to go out on the track and, you know, become hurt. And that's what he was being. He didn't care about GP. He was caring about AMA and his brothers. And that's, he was still that hot at the time, trying to make sure that series is being taken care of and they're, you know, properly riding around on the track. So After that, I did get a chance to go back up to him, and I just shook his hand and said, "Hey, I'm sorry. I messed your time." He goes, "Oh, no worries, man. I was just taking care of stuff. It's just the heat of the moment." But, you know, he shook my hand. We talked for a little bit, and he was, like I said, the nicest guy after that. You know, even, and you stop and think, even somebody who was that upset took the time to just kind of say, "Hey, just not right now. You know, don't bother me." Still a big guy to say that. Instead, he could have just Max Biaggi and just walked right past me. So, but, you know, he's that guy that, you know, everybody in Laguna Seca, you saw all the 69 banners. And I think without Nicky going to GP and bringing the success that he did when he did, GP never comes back to Laguna.
Yeah.
The track doesn't get, you know, all the money dumped into it to renovate it, to bring it up to spec. And you don't see this huge following in America. So I would say from about, you know, without his 2006 championship, MotoGP would be about half as big as it is in America. And that's saying a lot, but that's just saying how big of a person he was to not only race fans here in the States, but race fans worldwide.
Yeah, and, you know, you see that now, you know, on Cameron Bobier, on Joe Roberts, and all these young American racers, you know, on their Instagrams, on their Twitters, you know, when they're saying goodbye to Hayden, all of them say, you know, "You're my hero, you're my idol, you're my inspiration." So I think that it's very true that, you know, without Nicky Hayden, US racing would be in a very different place. You know, when Nicky Hayden was on the podium in Laguna for World Superbikes, that was absolutely incredible. And, you know, I know that for me, when Nicky Hayden replaced Jack Miller in Aragon, you know, I was so happy to be going to Aragon because it meant that I got to see, you know, Nicky Hayden again. And, you know, there was a part of me that when Nicky Hayden replaced Danny Pedrosa on the factory Honda, it was just thinking, I need to get Mahindra to send me to Phillip Island so I can go see Nicky Hayden ride a factory Honda. And, you know, likewise with Aragon, you know, I like to go out and, you know, occasionally take some photos. Some of them are in focus, which is always nice. But there's only one photo I wanted to get in focus that weekend, and it was Nicky Hayden coming out of the what I think it's like turn 11 or something like that. So I stood at turn 11 for like three MotoGP practice sessions, just fucking taking the same photo at like 1,250 shutter speed, which for anybody who takes photos is fucking ridiculous for trying to take a motorcycle photo. But eventually I did get it, and eventually I did get one at a sort of respectable frame rate as well. But, you know, Nicky Hayden, as you say, just had that draw to him. And yeah, as I was saying, you know, World Superbikes, when he was on the podium in Laguna Seca, that was, you know, that was absolutely unbelievable. And I'm sure that Nicky Hayden, you know, gave World Superbikes a big boost in the US in these last couple of years as well. So he's going to be sorely missed. And, you know, he was the last of the dirt riders, last of the flat trackers to come over and make it big. And, you know, in all honesty, without Hayden, there's now a pretty big hole in American racing that hopefully some young guys can step up and fill. But just one more quick anecdote about Nicky Hayden. So Nicky Hayden's last tweet, and I think this says a lot about Nicky Hayden, his last tweet was retweeting a fan's tweet, and the fan's tweet said, thanks for today, Nicky. For us, you're always number one. You must learn Italian, and I need to learn English." And so Hayden quote retweeted that and said, "I'm still trying to learn English too, winky face." And I, you know, there's not many riders who would, you know, A, retweet one of their fans, and B, you know, poke fun at themselves when retweeting their fans. So, you know, Hayden was, as we said, he was a good rider, but a better person off the bike, which I think is something that's becoming increasingly rare in motorcycle racing. And, you know, you have a lot of guys like Danny Kent, like Jack Miller, like Cal Crutchlow, you know, posting messages that Nicky sent them. You know, when Danny Kent was world champion, Nicky Hayden, you know, sent him a message, you know, telling him congratulations and enjoy it. Jack Miller shared a poster that Nicky sent when Jack stepped up to MotoGP, you know, telling him to have a good time. And then Cal Crutchlow, when Cal took over for Nicky at the factory Ducati seat, Nicky wrote him a poster and said, "Sorry, I forgot to clean up, Cal. Have a good one." And, you know, again, you know, how many, you know, did Valentino Rossi leave, you know, a signed poster for Ben Spies when Spies took over in the factory Yamaha? I don't think so.
No.
But yeah, you know, that's just the sort of guy, you know, Nicky was. And yeah, you know, it's, as you say, it's, you know, it's hard to come to terms with it. You know, lots of these guys and girls that go out on track, you know, they're superheroes. You know, they put on their their funny coloured suits, and then they go do superhuman things, you know, things that us fans can only begin to comprehend, you know, doing something, you know, even as tenth as impressive as what they do on a motorcycle. So it is always a big shock when anything like this does happen to you know, any sort of racer. But I think Nicky Hayden has hit a lot of people a lot harder than anybody else.
Scott Bolton here. Last week, when Skylar and I started the show, word had just filtered out of Italy earlier that day of Nicky Hayden's unfortunate road accident after being struck by a car while bicycling near the Misano circuit in Italy. At the time of our recording, it had become apparent that it was a serious situation, that Nicky was badly injured. Of course, we and the rest of the not only motorcycle racing world, but the racing world in general, held out hope that things would turn out for the better and Nicky would start to improve and recover to the best extent possible. But as we all know now, that wasn't to be. Yesterday, the news came out that Nicky had succumbed to his injuries and had passed away at 35 years old. So I wanted to share a few memories that I have. I'd been following not only Nicky, but the whole Racing Hayden family since 1998. And, of course, Nicky started his pro career in 1997, midway through the season, upon turning 16 and being able to get a pro license. And in 1998, after a four-year absence, the AMA Road Race Series made a return to Road Atlanta the last weekend of May for the Big Kahuna Nationals. And that was my first introduction to the Hayden family. Nicky was there racing in 600 Super Sport and 750 Super Stock. And his brother Tommy was there racing as well. So that weekend, Nicky actually qualified second for the 750 Super Stock race and had a DNF, but came home just outside the top 10 and 11th in the 600 Super Sport race, with his brother Tommy finishing 6th. He rode a Suzuki that year for the Hypercycle team. So I saw him race there the remaining years that he was in AMA competition. 2009, of course, he became the youngest 600 Super Sport winner or champion in AMA road racing. 2000, he signed with the factory Honda team and moved up to Superbike on the RC51. 2001, he had some injuries, had a wrist injury preseason, and had to have some surgery after the Daytona 200, and kind of put a damper on his year, but he still managed to have some good results. But 2002 was, I'd say, in a lot of people's eyes, Nicky's most successful year as far as race wins. He won the Daytona 200, went on to win 8 more AMA Superbike races on the RC51, and I saw him win 2 of those races at Road Atlanta, the doubleheader there, where he beat the reigning multi-time champion Matt Mladen. So Nicky went on to win the title for AMA Superbike in 2002, the youngest AMA Superbike champion, and also had a flat track win that year, so he's pulling double duty, doing what he loved to do. As everybody knows, in 2003, he went directly into MotoGP to the factory Honda team alongside Valentino Rossi. and progressed. And then in 2005, as the series returned to Laguna Seca, Nicky took his first MotoGP win there. I can remember, unfortunately, not being there to see it in person, but watching on TV and just, you know, the pride I had just to, you know, finally get an American back on the top box in MotoGP. 2006, of course, anybody who's followed the sport for any length of time knows that was the epic battle between Nicky and Valentino Rossi for the championship that year. Nicky took two wins, one again at Laguna Seca, and took the win at Assen, narrowly defeating fellow American Colin Edwards Jr. And, of course, you know, they had the Pedrosa-Hayden incident at Estoril. And Danny was definitely not the most popular rider amongst the American fans at that point. But, you know, Nicky said that if he had helped him at Valencia to wrap up that title, he'd let things go. And Danny did help him out, and Nicky won the title. And being a man of his word, as we all know he was, he let it go. And it was the last American world champion to this date in a major motorsports category. Of course, you know, we've had several in the MotoGP class, in the 500cc class over the years with Kenny Roberts Jr. and Kevin Swans, Wayne Rainey, Eddie Lawson, Kenny Roberts. But, yeah, that's the last one up to this point. So, anyway, as everybody knows, they went to the 800cc's in 2007 and didn't really, even though Nicky was running the number one plate that year, it didn't really fit him that well. That bike was more built and designed around Danny Pedrosa, and Nicky just, you know, looked too big on the bike. You know, it was hard for him. And but he, as he always did, he put in his best effort possible. Of course, then he went on to Ducati, and first couple of years at Ducati had some success. Got some podiums. You know, had some good top five finishes. But and of course, when Valentino came over to team up with him. You know, that program, as everybody most remember, kind of went awry. They just started chasing after anything they could to try to get Valet comfortable on the bike, and it really, you know, threw both riders seemingly down the wrong path for the most part that year. Anyway, Nicky, of course, ended his GP career at the Aspar Honda open class team, and you know, wasn't the best of years, you know, underpowered equipment, and but as always, he did you know, give it his all. And you know, one of my great memories of Nicky in MotoGP is the first year that they ran at Indy in 2008, and his first MotoGP race I'd attended. And that was the Hurricane GP. But Nicky brought the Repsol Honda home that day in second place. And then the next year on the Ducati, got another podium in third. And definitely proud moments to see Nicky standing on the box up there at his home GP. 2016, made the move over to World Superbike for the Tenkate Honda team, and finally got to see Nicky back in the victory spot on the podium when he took the race one win at Sepang in the sixth round of the season that year. Once again, just super proud to see that, as we all knew he did, that Nick still had it in him to race for wins when you know, he had the equipment and the circumstances were right to do so. And of course, we came to 2017, where the Honda brought out the new the redesigned Fireblade, and obviously, as we had seen up to this point of the season, him and Stephan Bradl both are struggling with that newer bike as they got it late and were developing it. I was really looking forward to seeing the second half of the season when they started to hopefully get more handle on that bike and hopefully see Nicky be able to grab a few podiums and hopefully put himself in a strong position to make a run for the title next year, but just wasn't meant to be. Anyway, my friend Larry Lawrence, who's been covering the American road racing and flat track scene for several decades, covered the Hayden brothers throughout their career. He wrote a piece on his Rider Files site, riderfiles.wordpress.com, and I wanted to read it. It's kind of said things well, especially from an American fan's viewpoint. Here's what Larry wrote. One of the most devastating days ever. Nicky Hayden is dead. It hurts so much, not only because of what Nicky accomplished as a racer, but for the future we had envisioned for our beloved world champion. In our ideal world, Honda was going to get Nicky a motorcycle capable of winning in World Superbike, and he was going to win races in the World Superbike Championship. Then Nicky was going to retire from world competition and come home to Moto America as a rider team owner with a factory Honda squad. Nicky, along with Wayne Rainey, were finally going to bring road racing back in America. And then on his off weekends from road racing, Nicky was going to unveil a secret flat track machine Honda had quietly developed, and he was going to finally win a mile, preferably Springfield, and join Dick Mann, Kenny Roberts, Bubba Schobert, and Doug Chandler as the fifth AMA Grand Slam winner. Then Nicky was going to retire from racing, run his racing team, get married, have kids, and create the next generation of racing Haydens. Then he was going to grow old, make appearances at special events, be inducted into the halls of fame, and be a beloved figure in the sport of motorcycle racing for the rest of his live-long days. Nicky was so incredibly talented. We felt all the hopes we had for him were within his grasp. Life had other ideas. That's why Nicky's loss hurt so much. It wasn't just the final curtain for one of our all-time great American motorcycle racing heroes. It was the loss of what might have been, what should have been in an ideal world. Larry Lawrence. The definition of world is the earth, together with all its countries, peoples, and natural features. The definition of champion is a person who has defeated or surpassed all rivals in a competition, especially in sports. Nicky Hayden was and will always be a world champion. Heartfelt condolences go out to his wonderful family. I've had the honor of meeting and talking to his father, Earl, and his mother, Rose. Had the honor of interviewing his kid brother, Roger. And for them, for his fiance, Jackie, for all of his friends and fans, a great void is left by the passing of Nicky Hayden. But we'll move on, and as the years go down the road, we'll have fond memories of the Kentucky kid. And for me and many others, he'll always be our hero. Godspeed, Nicky.
Yeah, and so, I'm sure I speak for myself and, well, of course for myself, but for the Motopod family and fans out there, that we send our best wishes and condolences to the Hayden family, his mom and dad, his brothers and sisters, his nieces and his fiance Jackie, and we hope the best for them, and that they get some closure. And that's all I got.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to transition away from that. There was a little incident during the Le Mans GP that Nicky Hayden probably would have, cracked one of his trademark smiles at. But in the Grand Prix Safety Commission, it does seem like maybe some of Jack Miller's Australian humour got taken the wrong way by Jorge Lorenzo. So they will be bringing in a new tyre construction from Mugello onwards, a stiffer front. And that was passed by a vote of like 20-3 or something. So, almost all of the field wanted it. Apparently Jorge Lorenzo was one of the three who didn't want it. And apparently he was kicking up a bit of a fuss. So Jack Miller, in true Jack Miller and Australian style, said, Jorge, shove your opinions up your ass. So Jorge then went on a bit of a rant to some Spanish journalists about, Jack shouldn't talk like that to anybody, especially not a five-time champion like me. And it all seems a bit of, a character clash between Jorge Lorenzo and Jack Miller, who are quite different characters, you have to say. But overall, it's not really any huge drama. It's just a bit of a lover's tiff between the two. So a couple of people said that Jack won't be getting any more free Caesar salads from Jorge Lorenzo's museum in Andorra. Of course, both of them live in Andorra. But I don't think that this will, have any real impact on anything, apart from maybe a couple of funny quotes in some press conferences or something.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I used to work on a drag racing team with a few Aussies, and it's something I learned about a lot of Aussie guys. You can't take a lot of shit seriously. They're always quick to give you some crap, I'll tell you that much. But yeah, I'm sure Jack admit nothing about that, but Lorenzo, he's not going to take that too well.
No, he definitely didn't. But yeah, that was the only real... real news out of Le Mans. It's obviously still pretty early. I think we talked about Zarco last time. So, that was that. Both Aspar and Avinti have also signed with Ducati for next year. So they'll have Ducati machinery. We don't yet know their riders. But silly season starting to truck along here. So hopefully we'll have some fun updates there. I guess we'll just jump straight into the racing. Of course, Moto3, it was another memorable Moto3 weekend. It was Nicolò Belega who set the fastest lap in qualifying, but then he had that lap time removed due to exceeding track limits. So Jorge Martin was back on pole ahead of Belega. Good to see the KTM now coming good. It was definitely a Honda party before, but now the KTM's coming good. Juan Fangavara, he was third, which I believe is his first ever front row. Then Romano Fenati was in fourth. Alberto Reynas on the Mahindra was fifth. So that was good for the Indian manufacturer. Nicolò Antonelli, he was sixth. No doubt given a bit of a giddy up by Danny Kent rocking up into their garage. Marcos Ramirez in seventh. Juan Mir eighth. Bo Ben Schneider ninth. Danny Kent 10th. Anea Bastianini 11th. And then beyond that, there weren't too many big surprises in terms of people, missing out on qualifying. Maybe McPhee down in 25th was probably a bit of a surprise, actually. But otherwise, it was pretty much a business as usual in Moto3 qualifying.
McPhee's been struggling in qualifying in those last couple of races. It's a bit weird, and he seems to come good on Sundays. Saturday's been giving him a bit of trouble, but it is kind of surprising that he's having, with the earliest success he had, I thought he was going to be this guy that was kind of like, the rest of the Belega and stuff like that. And he seemed to, miss the setup here the last couple of races.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, if it is just setup or if there's something deeper. But hopefully McPhee can rally, because, he did look really, really strong in those opening flyaways.
Yeah.
And I think it'd be a shame just to see his championship just fade away. I'm good to see Danny Kent in the top 10 in qualifying. In all honesty, that's a lot better than I thought Danny Kent would do. So fair play to him. He was the third of those Red Bull KTM IO bikes. But obviously, Bo Benschneider and Nicolò Antonelli have been racing in that class for the last couple of years, have been testing on that bike. So both of those guys probably got the kick up the pants that they needed with Danny Kent rocking up and being pretty quick. Because during practice, Danny Kent was up there as well. Then we got to the race, and whew, what a Moto3 race. As I said, Skyle, I think both you and I have watched a lot of racing in our time. But I can honestly hold my hands up and say I've never seen anything like what happened in the Moto 3 race when that oil went down.
No, it's almost something that when the oil goes down, they typically red flag it right at the get go because that's what you fear is going to happen. Riders going down, and that was I'd never seen that many go down, especially the leaders, but to simultaneously at different parts of the turn at that, not just like one spot, but just completely get washed out. It was one, it was crazy to see, but it was also very scary watching how many bikes were going down.
Yeah, huge. Yeah, I think it was like 20 bikes or something in total went down. So, you know, it was more than half the field. And as you say, quite scary to watch. Niccolo Antonelli, you know, channeled his inner Neo. And there's a clip floating around on Twitter of, you know, Niccolo Antonelli basically, you know, Neo backbending to avoid somebody's bike flying towards him. But it was incredible to see that everybody, you know, was able to eventually remount and restart the race. So what had happened, it seems, I'm not 100% sure, but Lorenzo Della Porta, Kornfile, Suzuki and Adam Norodine had all gone down on the exit of the Turn 3 chicane. And it looked like Norodine had then remounted and his bike was leaking oil. So as you quite rightly said, Skyler, he leaked oil pretty much throughout an entire corner all over the racing line. So we had some people, you know, crashing at the apex, some people crashing under braking. And it was just like Skittles. And, you know, as you also said, you know, incredible that everybody was more or less okay. There were definitely one or two boys who were a little sore there. You know, I know that Albert Arenas, he got hit by a bike and he was in quite a lot of discomfort when he came back in. Juan Mir, you know, he could barely walk because his left leg was hurting from getting hit by a bike and you know, crashing. And, you know, in fairness to them, they actually got that for an oil spill of that size. They got it cleaned up pretty quick. It was, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes delay, which gave all the teams enough time to fix the bikes. There were some pretty frantic scenes in the garages, that's for sure. The mechanics earned their money that day. But as I said, you know, fair play to the FIM for getting that oil spill cleaned up, you know, pretty quickly.
Yeah, I have the right here in my notes. The mechanics earned their money that day. So yeah, I guess we're on the same page there. But something else, two important injuries that actually did occur during that crash. Belega, he was the one that seemed to need the most medical care at the scene. It took him a little while to get him going. It seemed that he was clutching at his back. And when he got back to the pits, he actually, when the camera came in, he flipped his visor back down because he probably had a few tears coming out from the amount of pain he was in. And then Antonelli, seemed like his visor had flipped up and he had caught some gravel in his eye, which the reason why I want to point those out, because it may have come to play into how their races went for both of those guys.
Certainly for Belega, I mean Antonelli. Antonelli ended up crashing twice.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunately that's sort of just what Antonelli does.
Yeah. He did. I just hope he didn't go out there and his eye was starting to swell shut on him and he was getting some kind of weird tunnel vision and screwing up his braking. I don't know, but
no, but definitely with Niccolò Belega, you know, it's Belega would actually go to the hospital after the race to get a CT scan. But, you know, Belega, as soon as the lights went out, he just dropped like a stone. He was clearly in immense pain, you know, finished 17th out of 23 finishes. So, you know, that's not what we expect from Niccolò Belega. But it does look like that CT scan said that everything was clear. So Adam Norodine was the only rider not to restart. Albert Arenas, he fell pretty early in the race and said that there was still a bit of oil at that corner that maybe they'd missed. And then we had a pretty runaway lead from Romano Fenati, and it looked like it was going to be a repeat of Austin. But then Fenati crashed under no real pressure.
Juan Mir was running him down a little bit.
Was he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what might have got him to get it, because he had closed the gap down for about half a second there and was closing in per laps. But he wasn't under immense pressure. He was, you know, Mir was gaining slightly. A couple tenths of a lap here and there, but but Fenati was completely on his own when he bent it.
Yeah, and so with Fenati falling, he was unable to remount. A similar thing happened to Jorge Martin, who was up there as well. Martin crashed, you know, soon after Romano Fenati, which then left Juan Mir with basically a 3-second lead. And so then you know Juan Mir just potted along to victory. He you know was never really challenged, just kept the race you know nice and safe. Said that he, you know, changed a couple of his lines for a couple of laps, you know, where the oil had been spilled just to make sure that he wouldn't get caught out. But behind that, we actually had a really cracking battle for second place between Canet, Binder, DiGian Antonio, Ramirez, Guevara, Bastianini. Lots of these guys all there, all fighting. Darren Binder, you've no doubt seen it. He had a massive moment.
Yes.
You know, probably bunny hopped the bike. There's a clip on that on the MotoGP Twitter account. It's one of the biggest moments I think I've ever seen. And he just lands, gets straight back in the bubble like nothing has ever happened.
Yeah, two wheels off the ground, sideways, shoulder on the gas tank, feet above the bike, gets back on. You wouldn't even know because he lost, what, two positions and he was still in the fight?
Yeah, it was just like he'd run a bit wide, not, you know, almost being thrown to the moon. You know, Darren is riding really, really well, and I think that a podium is just around the corner. Unfortunately, he would crash. I think he was on the second last lap, just trying to push a bit too hard.
Yeah.
But it seems like the pace for him and for Ramirez is definitely there. You know, in the last two races, that Platinum Bay Real Estate team has been, you know, by far the best KTM when the Red Bull KTM team, the factory team, has been struggling a bit. And it seems like that Platinum Bay team have really just got a good base setting for the KTM that sort of just works everywhere, you know, isn't the best, but is just a really solid foundation for both of their riders. So, you know, I think that we'll see Ramirez and Darren Binder on the podium. But before too long, because both of them are riding really, really well, and I think that they are pretty talented riders.
Yeah, Ramirez has said back-to-back fourth, so he's due for a podium for sure. And, you know, he missed out just by the smallest of margins. Yeah. And had Darren Binder just let go of the brake lever just a little sooner, he'd probably been on the podium that race crashing out. But he was there ready for us. Like you said, they are due for podiums. And, you know, not even podiums, but, you know, they have a good chance of, you know, winning one of these races.
Yeah, certainly. You know, Darren was right up there in Jerez as well before he crashed. Juan Fangravera, he was in fifth. Of course, he was the only RBA racing team bike out there as Gabriel Rodrigo broke his collarbone again. So unfortunate for Rodrigo. Bastianini, he was up in sixth, ahead of Jules Daniello, Andrea Migno in eighth. Bo Benschneider was the leading Red Bull KTM IO bike, of course, Antonelli crashing out, and he was one place ahead of Danny Kent. So Danny Kent in the top 10 on his return. Not too bad. We still don't know what Danny Kent's going to be doing for the rest of this season. Could he come back in a Moto3 and fight for victories? I don't know. He can definitely be in the top 10, we know that. But I'm not sure if he has the same pace as Mir and Fanardi when Fanardi doesn't crash. But hopefully Danny Kent, you know, can get a ride somewhere, because I think his return to Moto3 showed that, you know, even what Stefan Kiefer said, that Danny Kent has a lot of natural talent, and it would be a big shame to see something like that go to waste, I think. Then behind him was Jakob Kornfeld. John McPhee eventually finished in 12th. Nakhon Adarat Fuvapat, he finished in 13th, ahead of Lorenzo Della Porta and Marco Bezzecchi. And then failing to score were Olivio Loi, Belega, and those were the only real big names. But yeah, it was, you know, a great Moto3 race, as we're so used to seeing in the lightweight class.
How in the hell did you say that last name? I'm sitting here looking at how many...
it's only because I did 2 years of Sev commentary and he was in the Asia talent team. So I literally would spend, you know, 20 minutes a day until I got it, typing it into Google Translate, getting the Google Translate voice to read it out and like breaking it down syllable by syllable. There's a couple of Thai riders in the CEV now who I don't think I'd be able to say their names. Like they have some of the longest and just most complex last names you'll ever see.
Yeah. I've never seen so many syllables so quickly fired out of a gun there. I was like, what? How? No, not even. Not even. I wasn't even going to try. I was going to be like, yeah, this Nakhon A. Yeah, he was doing just fine.
Yeah. He's probably one of these guys who, you know, his nickname is Tim or something like that. Like there's a Ukrainian rider in World Supersport 300, Mikita Kalinin. And he says, oh, just call me Nick. What? That's nowhere near either of your names.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Juan Mir now has a pretty solid lead, 99 points over Ramona Fanardi's 65 points. But then that battle for second is very, very tight. Canet on 63, Jorge Martin on 59, John McPhee on 53, Fabio De Gian Antonio on 51, Andrea Migno on 43. Migno still the leading KTM in the championship. Marcos Ramirez is in 8th with 36 points ahead of Juan Fangravera. Then Enea Bastianini in 10th. Belega in 11th. Not what we're expecting from either of the Italians this season. Nicolo Antonelli in 17th overall. So you'd have to say that all three of their title challenges are probably quite quickly slipping away unless they can start doing a lot of winning. And it's Yes, I don't know. Nicola Antonelli continues to be the biggest question mark for me because, you know, the kid has a lot of talent. And, you know, I think everybody thought that going into IO with Aki IO, you know, one of the best mentors for young riders and one of the best teams for young riders, would be an absolute force. But it seems like he's crashing more now than he ever did. And I don't know if any journalists out there are listening. A piece, I will buy your magazine if you do a piece with Nicky IO and with Nicola Antonelli on what the F is happening in that team. Because, yeah, it's just incredible to see. Very, very confusing.
Yeah, his confidence has got to be shot to shit by now because, you know, like we've had several interviews, and I think Dave's talked about this, and once it's, you know, the last, you know, 5/10 is between the ears, and he seems like he's lost the last 2 seconds between the ears. He's had a just tough season, and I wonder if he's going to be a bit of an Aleix. You know, you give him the good bike, and it's like, nah, gets on the bad bike, and he's going to fly. So he's a tough one to crack, but, you know, I feel bad that he's having the tough year because, you know, he was up in the, what was he, fourth? When the oil dump and they went down and he never quite got it back together. So he might have had a completely different race had he not crashed in the very beginning, yeah. You know, and then got something, you know, his eye was all red and swelled up. Then he crashed two more times. And of course, that didn't, you know, that's not going to help his confidence at all.
No, but, definitely not. Yeah. I mean, I heard some stat that in preseason testing, so they did like 4 preseason tests, Nicola Antonelli crashed 17 times.
Ooh. I guess it's giving Randy Desponnet's record a run then, huh?
Yeah. So that was, pretty amazing, in all honesty, for young Antonelli. Then we move on to Moto2. I didn't see too much of Moto2 over the weekend, so apologies if there are some blanks. But it was the master of Le Mans, Tom Lucci, on pole, ahead of Francesco Bagnaia. Now, Pecco is, you know, really making some waves in Moto2, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that a lot of what Pecco showed on the Mahindra last year is now coming to fruition and showing that, you know, he wasn't just a Moto3 wonder. You know, he didn't have any cheap bits on his bike. But Pecco is, you know, very much like Rins, like Vinales, and has a lot of talent. And it seems like that first win for Pecco is probably just around the corner in Moto2 to, as we said, you know, emulate what Maverick Vinales, what Rins did in their first years of Moto2, which I think is going to, you know, line up some big things for him. And, you know, really pleased for Pecco. Got to work with him a bit last year, and, you know, he's such a nice guy, you know, very, very quiet off the bike, but, you know, always polite, always a professional. So, yeah, all the best to Pecco. He was ahead of Franco Morbidelli. Luca Marini up in fourth. Good to see Marini up there as well, showing some of that speed he had in the Sev, ahead of Agata. Alex Marquez was sixth, and that was with a broken foot. Ahead of Matteo Pisini, Baldessari in eighth, Schroeter in ninth, and then Cortese in tenth. And then Yoni Hernandez, who was 13th. Miguel Oliveira was all the way down in 17th spot. So it doesn't really seem like the KTM Moto2 bike likes the Le Mans circuit. Fabio Quartararo, he was down in 20th. So, you know, just compare, you know, Pecco Bagnaia and Fabio Quartararo, where, you know, Quartararo was being hailed as the next Marc Marquez. And, you know, he had a tough time in Moto3. He had a strong start in Moto2, but Quartararo is still not really finding that magic. Whereas, you know, Pecco's, you know, continuing to wow people. Jorge Navarro, you know, he's another one. Great Moto3 rider. He qualified down in 21st. And Navarro, you know, continues to just crash basically once a session, it seems. Taran McKenzie, replacement to Danny Kent in the Kiefer Racing team. He did pretty well to qualify in 29th ahead of Edgar Pons and Kyrill Idampawi. So, you know, get on that bike, a track he's never seen, a bike he's never ridden, no testing, and to not qualify last is fairly impressive, I reckon, for the young Scottish rider.
Yeah, and Moto2 is where you're going to see, I think, the most impact Valentino Rossi's camp has had on MotoGP.
Yeah.
His statement of wanting to have more Italians in racing, you're seeing it just in qualifying alone. I think 5 or 6 of his guys were in the top 10. That'll work.
Pecco, Morbidelli, Marini, Baldessari, and then Pisini, sort of. Pisini's not really in the VR46 Academy.
But he does show up
to hang out with him a lot.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, as you say, you know, that, you know, what Rossi's doing is, you know, really starting to pay off, in especially in Moto 2. We're starting to see it a bit more in Moto 3, but I think just based on, you know, when Rossi started the VR46 Academy, that Moto 2 is where we'll see it for the next couple of years. But then I'm sure that we'll start to see some pretty quick Italians in Moto 3 as well. You know, certainly if Belega isn't, you know, riding injured, I reckon, you know, he's already proven what he can do. So Valentino Rossi, impressive on the track, and, you know, doing great things for Italian racing future as well.
Alrighty, so that gets us onto the Moto 2 race, where Franco Morbidelli, you know, it was once again, you think he's going to get out front and run away with this, and for a time it did, and then the guy we've been talking about, Pecco, he just, you know, he gets around, he's in a little battle with Luffy and Alex Marquez there for a little bit, and he gets by them, and then you're thinking, yeah, those guys are going to just chop each other up, and Bagnaia's not going to have a chance to get up there, and then he just starts taking tenths out of Morbidelli here, there, and he never quite catches, but he gets within half a second, and they're both on, you know, lap record pace at this point. And I was completely impressed by the pace that this guy could run, considering, you know, he's a rookie, but the team is also rookies to this. Yeah. And they've got, you know, they don't have any notes, they don't have a base there. So I mean, I'm sure, you know, KLX can help them with some things. And now, for sure, they're going to be knocking on that door, wanting to make sure that Bagnaia is getting the best help that he can get. But so a rather impressive effort to also finish ahead of who seems like the king of Le Mans. But, you know, Luthi, once again, you know, gets in a battle with Alec Marquez in the beginning and seems to lose touch of the leaders, and then can never quite regain the speed that he was showing earlier in the week to run them down. But Luthi had a great race to finish third in front of Alex Marquez, who, with a broken foot, finishing fourth in a race and not, you know, overriding. He did hold off Luthi for quite a while because he's such a deep breaker. Had a great performance to finish in fourth ahead of Mattia Pessini, who has been poking around the top, you know, four or five spots here for the last couple of races. He's having a great season. He's quietly kind of, you know, without you know, a little crash here or there, he's definitely been kind of the unsung guy in Moto 2. And it's kind of good to see a guy that's been around for so long and, you know, maybe hanging out in that VR46 camp, like we were just saying, is also paying dividends to sharpen his blade a little bit. But he finishes the fifth ahead of Dominic Agutter, who's, you know, still doing good things on the Cedar. Taka Nakagami makes his return to the top 10 after having a tough couple races there. Simone Corsi in eighth, Xavi Verhe in ninth, Yanni Hernandez getting in the top 10, and Yanni is slowly making his way back to the front of the field, which is good to see because he is just about the most exciting person you're ever going to see throw a Moto2 bike sideways into a corner and not crash, and you can't figure out why. Javi Siren finishing 11th, Marshall Schroeder in 12th, in front of Ricky Cardoose, who's filling in for the still-injured Brad Binder, which we might see in Mugello, you think?
Yeah, maybe. He's sort of aiming to be back Mugello, Barcelona, one of those two races. But, you know, both Binder and Akiayo, the team manager, are firmly in the camp of the arm has to be 100%. He has to be, you know, fully fit to come back. There's no point, you know, doing anything silly. They know they can't win the title this season. So get healthy and, you know, don't risk the rest of your career. Don't risk, you know, an injury that, you know, is going to haunt you in later life when, you know, you can't move your arm due to the pain. So time will tell. But, you know, Ricky Cardoso is doing a great job filling in for Binder, you know, definitely getting a lot of good data for that bike and, you know, picking some points, beating Oliveira for the first time as well. Not sure what happened to Oliveira this race, down in 17th, one spot ahead of Fabio Quartararo. That KTM had been going so well, especially with the Portuguese rider. But yeah, you know, it's still an early project and, you know, Oliveira is only in his second full season of Moto 2. So maybe a bit of lack of experience coming in there as well, but hopefully they'll be back up there. Yeah. There weren't too many other surprises throughout the field, really.
No. And, I don't know if we covered this in the last one, if we brought it up, but just in case, some of you may wonder why they just don't throw Danny Kent onto the KTM to fill in for Brad Binder. And that's because Ricky Cardoose is actually their contracted test rider. So when someone goes down, he is the guy that fills in for that team.
Yeah, that. And, you know, he's also, as the name suggests, tested that bike. So already knows what it feels like, whereas Danny Kent would be starting from scratch. And, you know, as we said, Ricky Cardoose, sure, he never had, you know, amazing results in Moto 2, but, you know, he'd get the occasional top 10 here and there, and, you know, he doesn't crash too much anymore. So, you know, that's pretty much what you want from a test and a replacement rider.
Right, someone who's not going to throw it down the track but give you good information.
Yeah, exactly. And so then moving on to the championship standings as my phone falls on the floor. Franco Morbidelli, 100 points, 20 points clear of Tom Lutie with 80. Alex Marquez on 62, ahead of Oliveira on 59. Francesco Bagnaia up there in fifth place with 53 points. So, you know, clearly a rookie and already challenging, you know. Alex Marquez for third overall, certainly going to finish in the top five is Pecco, which is great to see, as we said. Nakagami, he's sixth, ahead of Dominic Agata. Vierge in eighth place on the Tech 3 machine, ahead of Luca Marini, and then Simone Corsi on the speed up rounds out the top 10. So, you know, there's actually a decent mix of bikes in that top 10. You know, it's a Kalix 1-2, then a KTM, then two more Kalixes, then a Suda, then a Tech 3, then a Kalix, then a speed up. So, you know, I think it does prove that, you know, you can get up there on different bikes aside from the Kalix. So hopefully we'll see a couple more different sorts of motorcycles next year. No real surprises further down the field. Yoni Hernandez in 16th is a bit disappointing. You know, certainly with MotoGP experience, we did expect Hernandez to be a fair bit stronger. But it's proving that, you know, Moto2 is a very, very, very tough class for anybody to come into.
Right, you can see in qualifying most times, you know, you'll get a second covering the first 10, another second covering the rest of the field. So you've got 2 seconds to find in a track, or else you're going to be spat out the back end, and it's like, all right, well, that's definitely a cutthroat class. But enough about Moto2, because I want to get on to not only the MotoGP race, but the qualifying for this weekend was...
Before that.
Oh, that's right.
Jack Miller's crash.
Oh, that was horrific.
That was probably the biggest MotoGP crash I have seen. I can't even think of one that comes close to it. It was one of the most frightening crashes I have ever seen. And, you know, I know that Nick Harris in commentary said that he was really glad that they didn't show that crash live.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad they didn't show that crash live either, because, you know, for those who maybe didn't see it, you know, BT Sport, I think they have a clip of it. And then there's, you know, a couple of the journalists have retweeted, you know, just fan clips who have filmed their TV. But Jack Miller lost the front going through turn one, which is a 300 kilometer an hour corner, and then essentially T-boned the wall at, you know, 250 Ks an hour, and was miraculously able to get up and walk away with, you know, a bit of an injured hand and a bit of a swollen knee. But, you know, it was, as we said, one of the most shocking crashes I have ever seen. And Jack Miller, you know, in his own words, said, "I'm a lucky boy to still be talking to you," when he was talking to BT Sport. So, yeah, I think that one definitely left Miller sore, but probably also left Miller a bit shaken. You know, he had that 1,000-mile stare when they showed him in the box when he was talking about it. So I don't know. It does sort of, you know, motorcycles keep getting faster, but tracks aren't really changing too much to accommodate that. And you know, I worry if we're going to get to the point in a couple of years where bikes are going too fast and we do have to, you know, either start going to different tracks or start drastically changing tracks to extend gravel traps and move back walls and all this sort of thing. Because, yeah, bikes keep getting faster.
Yeah, and we need to do something before... We need to be proactive, not reactive. Before,
yeah, exactly.
You know, something happens and, you know, it's like drag racing here. We did these, you know, we have a quarter mile is what it was set up, and then ran that for years. And then the cars got faster and faster and faster and faster. And but the tracks didn't get that much safer, and so eventually you went to a track that shouldn't have had the cars in the first place. Car has a failure, not enough room. Car collides with the structure, kills the driver. Okay, now we're only going to race to 1,000 feet. It's like, well, have we come to that decision by doing some calculations, or just not going to those tracks in the first place? This guy's still alive. So you don't want to see something like that happen. Mm. You want to be proactive and not reactive. And there's definitely tracks that need to be retrofitted. And there's probably tracks that MotoGP just doesn't need to go to anymore. And that's tough when you're a world, you know, organization where you want to hit as many countries as you can, because you want to put on the show for everyone, because it's a worldwide championship. It's just not a European championship. But yeah, even said that, you don't want to, you know, four races in Spain. You want to get around in some other countries.
One of those races in Catalonia. Thank you very much.
But yeah, so it was. I'm glad Jack was able to walk away. It took the announcer's breath away when I saw the replay of it at the very end. Because you see the bike early on. You see the bike and you see the front end is completely turned dead at 90. And you're like, how in the hell did he do that? Because it doesn't look like it. You see turn one is a sweeping right-hander. And if anything, he crashed on the inside of the turn. And you're figuring out, what, how? And then you watch it and his front regrips and sends him right into the wall. It's like, okay, well, that can't, that's a freak accident. And then Marquez almost does the exact same freaking thing. You're like, okay, that wall needs to go, or they need to change this turn or slow it down, or something needs to happen with that.
Yeah, exactly. And, Marc Marquez, as you said, a pretty similar crash in the race, but, also at Mugello during his rookie season, you'll probably remember Marquez had a pretty similar crash at turn one, where, again, this idea of, moving the wall and that sort of stuff did get brought up, because there are some very fast corners in MotoGP, and yeah, it's definitely one to keep in mind. But Jack Miller, if he was a cat, I think he probably used up more than one of his nine lives with that crash. So, great to see Jack walk away. But, unfortunately, another reminder of, just how on the limit and how dangerous, this sport that we all love can be. In typical Jack Miller fashion, so that crash happened in FP4. He then had to go out for Q2. He actually went 0.3 of a second faster after that crash than he had gone all weekend. So trust Jack Miller to be able to shake off a crash. He was a bit sore for the race. We'll get to that in a bit more detail in a second. But as you say, Skylar, qualifying, due to the strange weather we had some pretty big hitters in Q1. We had Dovizioso, Zarco, Pedrosa, Bautista, Folger, Lorenzo, Iannone, Aleix, Petrucci, Barbera, Lowe's, Rabat, and Gintoli all down there. So there were, six or seven riders who you would assume could have easily gotten those top two transfer spots. So from the word go, Q1 was pretty exciting. Danny Pedrosa, he unfortunately just missed the cut. He was third. But interestingly, I think Danny Pedrosa's time was still faster than Marc Marquez's time in qualifying. So, that's sort of the challenge of this Q1 and Q2 system, is that, you can set a time that would have set you third on the grid, but if you're only third in your session, then, there's not too much that you can do. But it was Dovizioso and home hero Johann Zarco who advanced through up into Q2. Jorge Lorenzo was set to start in 16th place, one spot ahead of Andrea Iannone. So, not the best qualifying for Lorenzo or for Iannone. And then, of course, as we said, Danny Pedrosa starting in 13th spot, which was less than ideal for him.
Right. And the way that the two that moved on, Dovizioso and Zarco, did it completely in two different ways. So Dovizioso does it in the traditional way. He goes out, runs a few laps, comes in with a little bit of time, changes onto a soft rear, fires in a lap, and goes on. Zarco went out on the same set of tires, ran the entire time. Didn't come into the pits. Lap after lap, he's getting faster and faster and faster and faster. The checkered flag goes out, and he's on his last lap, and he isn't setting his best two sectors, but he did set a very good third sector. So you're waiting for him to come across the line. Can he beat Danny's time? Because he's not going to touch Dovizioso's time, but he's within striking distance. And he comes out, and he nips him just by a little bit, and you thought he won the race with the reaction that you got out of that crowd. It was just magnificent. But what an effort to do that on 10 lap tires.
Yeah. And Zarco basically said that because he'd had a crash earlier in that day, is that he could only afford to use one set of the soft tire in that session. So sort of had to stay out. Johann Zarco continues to just impress everybody. And, he certainly impressed everybody in the race, but he didn't do too bad a job in Q2 either. Mm-mm. Where Johann Zarco eventually qualified in third place to make it an all Yamaha front row, with Vinales snaring pole ahead of Rossi. But that doesn't really tell the whole story, because it was an absolutely fantastic Q2 session with times, flying left and right, and, going right down to the end.
Yeah, you had, guys like, I think Cal Crutchlow held it, was up top for a little while. Marquez had the best time for a little while. And then Rossi was actually coming in, looked like a pole lap, and he just caught, I think, Jack Miller at the last couple corners and maybe lost, but then Miller crashed right in front of him, and I think Rossi had to slow up a little bit for that. And then, excuse me, then Rossi finishes just a few tenths off a pole. But, you know, it was definitely setting up what was going to be a great race, because you saw not only were the top three bikes, you know, Yamahas that were so closely matched, but even the next three guys behind them were right on there for the times, and it was going to be a tight race.
Yeah, it was going to be an incredible one. So it was, as you say, Cal Crutchlow in fourth, ahead of Marquez, Dovi in sixth, Redding seventh, Pol Espargaró. Both the KTMs actually got straight through to Q2, which was a pretty big achievement for them. Sure, the weather helped a bit, but, you know, they still had to get on there and ride it. So Pol Espargaró lined up eighth, ahead of Carol Abraham, Bradley Smith in 10th, Jack Miller 11th, which, given his, you know, the crash he'd had, was pretty damn impressive that he even managed to sit on the bike again. Definitely had to change his leathers and probably his underpants too. Loris Baz was then 12th. And then the racing got underway on Sunday. It was a glorious day in France. No sign of the rain we had. And Johann Zarco got an absolutely fantastic start. For my money, Johann Zarco is the best rider in MotoGP for the first three laps of a race. He seems to be able to find the limit with a full fuel tank absolutely perfectly, which is something that so many rookies and even so many experienced riders struggle with. But Zarco is able to, it seems like he's able to just have this super consistent pace. You know, we see, especially from rookies a lot, that they'll be strong either at the start of the race or at the end. And then, you know, there'll be a dip or a build up towards them being strong.
Right.
Because Zarco is just, from the word go, just such a high level.
Yeah, because even guys like when Ben Spies came in, that was one thing he struggled with, was a fuel, was a full tank and fresh tires. And at the end of the race, he'd be passing everybody back that passed him in the first five laps, and he'd come good. And like you said, Zarco, not only does he get it on the first lap, but he gets that bike off the line fantastically, but he just isn't scared to chuck it in the first corner or whatever else to slow it up. He's like, nah, these tires have been on the warmers, they're good. I'm going to throw it in there now. Like, geez. Like, the moves he made on the outside to set up the inside pass, and then not only get like, oh, you're thinking, okay, he's going to get passed back. No, he held it out there for a good, you know, four laps before he ended up getting passed by Vinales, who had to work hard to get past him and couldn't shake him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly the thing. As soon as Vinales and then eventually Rossi did get past Zarco, Zarco was still always within half a second of both of them, just waiting for a mistake. And Johann Zarco eventually did go on to get the podium that I don't think anybody was really surprised, in all honesty.
No.
I mean, you know, after Qatar and what he'd done in testing, you know, it sort of seemed inevitable that Zarco would get a podium at some point this season. Great to see him get it at home in front of the fans. You know, it's probably the only time I've ever heard a rider get a louder cheer than Valentino Rossi is when Johann Zarco was coming past any of the grandstands in Le Mans. You know, he's become an absolute superstar there. And, Johann Zarco, you know, he's still just being Johann Zarco, you know, quite quiet off the track. And that lets his riding really do the talking. And, you know, Zarco's announced to stay with that Tech 3 squad next year. You know, as we saw with Cal Crutchlow when he was with Tech 3. And as we see with Cal Crutchlow now, you know, being on a satellite bike now with a spec ECU and all those sort of things isn't the end of the world. You're probably not going to challenge for a championship. But, you know, you can still rack up, you know, consistent top fives, challenge for the podium, maybe even challenge for a win here and there. So I think there's some pretty big things on the horizon for Johann Zarco. And I can only imagine what everybody in Hamamatsu is thinking at Suzuki, thinking, why the fuck didn't we sign this kid?
Right.
Jesus Christ.
Right. I had that in my notes, too. It's like you're sitting there seeing, you know, pictures of Renz on the sideline and Gentoli's filling in. And meanwhile, here goes Zarco. That not only did you miss on maybe having this immense talent that could come in and help you, but he's risen past of a rookie status. He's no longer viewed as a rookie. He's viewed as a challenger. Other guys in the field are going to worry about him now. He's no longer like, he was good. Oh, it was a one-off race. Like, no, he's a competitor. He's going to be there week in and week out. He's going to be the guy that's going to ruffle your feathers. And the thing is he's very confident in his abilities, but he's a cold, calculated killer. Like he is like the Iceman out there. He never seems to get too riled up. He never seems to have too much emotion. But the one thing I do really like about Zarco is you stick a microphone and ask him a question. It's the only one you're going to have to ask him, because he's going to give you all the answers in one laid out description. But yeah, he's been a surprise this season, because everybody expected this Vinales and Marquez battle, which still kind of hasn't come to fruition yet.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's nice to see Rossi up there giving a fight, but Zarco was unforeseen, and it's been a nice surprise so far this year. And it doesn't look like he's getting any slower. He's getting better, which everyone should be quite concerned with.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's been up there in pretty much every race, there or thereabouts. But as you say, you know, a big highlight of this race was Vinales and Rossi, those final five laps where, you know, both Rossi and Vinales were trading lap records, both of them on the absolute limit. And, you know, it was all building towards a titanic clash in the last battle. In the post-race interviews, Maverick Vinales said, "I was planning to use the same move I used on Nico Tirol when I won my first 1-2-5 race if Rossi was ahead of me at the final corner." So, you know, he had a plan. Valentino Rossi, I think it was at like turn 8 or maybe a couple of turns before. Valentino Rossi had a massive moment under braking, but, you know, he was still keeping it together, closing in on Maverick Vinales until disaster. And Valentino Rossi crashed, I think it was 3 or 4 corners from the end. Absolute devastation for the doctor. But, you know, I think it proved just how hard Valentino Rossi was pushing, that, you know, he wasn't ready to settle for second. He could smell that win, and that is all that he wanted, which I think is testament to Valentino Rossi. You know, especially a rider of his age and, you know, in his position where I don't think he can win races every weekend, to say basically, F the championship, I want this win. Is a testament to, you know, what to, you know, Rossi being a true racer. And there were a lot of people on social media saying, "Oh, Rossi should have settled for second. Rossi should have settled for second." And I think that when you're within half a second of victory, and victories aren't going to come around every race for you, and if you settle for second, then I don't think you should be racing. You know, I think that what Rossi did was absolutely correct to keep pushing. And, you know, things like this happen. Everybody at the top is now at one mistake each, more or less. So it's not the end of the world, but you know, I think fair play to Rossi for giving it a go.
Yeah, I think watching that was tough because you're sitting there and it's almost like you're like, oh god, these guys are pushing way too hard. Something's gonna happen, and then it does, and you're like, oh, but it was, you know, like you said, four corners from the end. And you're like, oh, if he didn't hold the defensive line going into, like you said, there's like 8 or something like that, and he doesn't blow that corner. He leads, and it's like, you know, then is it Maverick that makes the silly move and then takes them both out? Or does Rossi, you know, outbreak himself into the final set of corners or runs wide and hits the curb and goes down? Who knows? But up until that point, best race of the year so far when it comes down, you know, especially the teammates battle out, evenly matched. And then, you know, the only person that would have benefited, I think, you know, from those two going down would have been Zarco, because he was sitting right back there. Like, if anybody settled, he definitely did, because he was there a lot closer than I think the last two laps. He decided, you know, I'm going to bring this home. Third is great. I'm going to be on the podium, and then gets a gifted second place. And, you know, he'll take that.
Yep. So Maverick Vinales did take Yamaha's 500th win in Grand Prix racing. So they bust out the T-shirts. And as you say, Zarco maybe did ease off a little bit in those last few laps, but I think Zarco is in a very different position to both of the factory Yamaha guys. You know, obviously as a satellite rider and as a rookie, you know, finishing even third on the podium is basically a victory. So fair play to Zarco. But then it was Danny Pedrosa who benefited the most, not only of Rossi's crash, but also of Marc Marquez's crash, as we alluded to earlier in the show. Marc Marquez did suffer a crash pretty identical to the one that Jack Miller had, where he just lost the front through turn one. Marquez tried to get going again, but couldn't. So another mistake for Marc Marquez. It's strange to see, you know. As we said, Vinales, he's had a mistake as well. But Marquez, just as he seemed to be getting his momentum back after Jerez, now, you know, now loses a fair bit of pace. Is now 27 points, I think it is.
Yeah, he crashed. Yeah, now 20. I was like, he crashed in that turn 3 times, I think, over the weekend too. So
yeah,
he was struggling there, and just it's kind of going to throw back to the Marquez of old, where just push, don't listen to what the bike's doing, and then crash or win. So yeah, that Marquez we saw last year, but you know, second, third, fourth was good enough to bring it home. That's kind of gone out the window. I think that leads to what you were just talking about with Rossi. If you're not trying to win it, you have no business being out there.
Yeah. So Marquez, unfortunately, he fell. We also had retirements for Hector Barbera, Carol Abraham, Scott Redding, Daniele Petrucci, and Alvaro Bautista. So a fair few Ducatis unable to finish in Le Mans. Alicia Spargo, he was also having a good race inside the top 10, but then unfortunately his engine went pop. So, you know, again, Alicia pretty devastated with that one. You know, a mistake, no fault of his own, saw him out of the race. Andrea Dovizioso, who was eventually able to finish fourth ahead of Cal Crutchlow. Cal Crutchlow and Danny Pedrosa, they had a bit of an incident, towards the start of the race. Crutchlow had run a bit wide, and then Pedrosa put through a pretty hard move. But Cal, after the race, said Danny probably couldn't see me. He was hanging that far off the bike, and it seems like there were no hard feelings between those two. Cal Crutchlow also said that, you know, had a heavier rider hit him, then Cal Crutchlow probably would have gone down. So, you know, thanking Danny Pedrosa for being the small little man that he is. Then Jorge Lorenzo, he was in sixth ahead of Jonas Folger. Jack Miller was eighth. Miller had been a bit higher, but then his hand and his knee and, you know, just general fatigue from that big crash started to wear down on him. Still finished in the top 10 ahead of Loris Baz, who was obviously a second French rider home. Andrea Iannone finally got inside the top 10 on the Suzuki. Tito Rabat in 11th, which was a great result for Tito Rabat. Paul Espargaro, Bradley Smith, Lowe's picked up his first points. And then Sylvain Guintoli, he picked up a MotoGP point on his MotoGP return, as there were only 15 finishers.
Yeah, no, you know, race of attrition there. The Ducati is that only one can be attributed to a crash, and that was Bautista early on, but everybody else retired with the mechanical, so definitely a tough one for those Ducatis there. Andrea Iannone, good to see him actually finish a race. That's nice.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, he's 15th in the World Championship standings, behind the likes of, you know, Loris Baz and Jonas Folger. But yeah, Iannone, I don't know what's going on with Iannone and that Suzuki. They just don't seem to be gelling at all. You know, Iannone, like, he looked good in the race, but, you know, he was still only battling for a top 10 when, you know, we know that Iannone and we know that Suzuki can battle for podiums and battle for victories. So, I don't know. Hopefully Iannone's season starts to turn around a little bit, because it's not looking too good for him right now. Obviously, Iannone, home race coming up in Mugello. I don't think we're going to be seeing Iannone break the MotoGP speed rate record again this year on the Suzuki. Maybe Jorge Lorenzo will get the outright speed record. But yeah, so championship standings, it is Maverick Vinales who now moves to the top of the table with 85 points. Then in second place, the dark horse for this championship, Danny Pedrosa, 68 points. This is Danny's year. I'm telling you, this is Danny's year. Mm. Everybody thought it would be Vinales and Marquez. No, it's Danny Pedrosa's year. Finally.
That'd be something.
It would be certainly something to see Danny Pedrosa win this title. Who knows? You know, we're still very early on. It's, you know, it's 17 points between Vinales and Pedrosa. Pedrosa definitely has the consistency. I'm not sure he or the Honda has the outright speed to win this championship. But if he can just keep, you know, chipping away, maybe one more mistake from Vinales, and maybe it's game on. Valentino Rossi slipped to third with 62 points, which put him 4 points ahead of Marc Marquez. Johann Zarco, fifth place, 55 points. Sure, he's 30 points behind Vinales, but he's only 3 points behind Marc Marquez. So once again, Johann Zarco, take a bow. In my defense, I was quite literally woken up this morning by a Skype message from Skylar asking if I was ready to record the show because I forgot to set my alarm. So that's why that Jonas Zarco came out there. Zarco, he's ahead of Dovizioso in sixth place. Cal Crutchlow is seventh, ahead of Jorge Lorenzo. Jorge Lorenzo with just 38 points, the same amount of points as Jonas Folger. Jack Miller still inside the top 10, ahead of Petrucci, Redding, Baz, Alicia Spargaro, Iannone, Bautista, Rabat with 13 points, Barbera. Barbera not really having a good season. We saw Barbera, you know, be able to get up there last year, but it seems like the change to the newer Ducati has not suited the number 8, as he now only has 12 points and is 18th in the championship. Carol Abraham in 19th ahead of Rins, Paul Espargaro, Bradley Smith, Sam Lowes, and then Sylvain Guintoli is 24th on virtue of his 1 point scored with that 15th place.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of guys that stepped up and got the newer Ducatis are struggling, and I wonder if a lot of that, because they're saying they're having trouble with the front end and getting the tires heated up or getting the feel, but if that has to do because those bikes were completely designed around all the winglets, and now that the winglets are off, they don't have, you know, those, you know, before they've been able to take the base setup as well from the factory team. And now they don't have a base setup because the winglets are all gone. So they're struggling to find a good setup for that bike, because it doesn't seem like any of the GB16s on are consistently up there on the weekends. The 17s do, you know, decently, but the 16s in it, you know, then you know, you got guys like Loris Baz on the 15s finishing ahead of the guys in the 16s again. So, you know, tough to say with that.
That could be a very good reason. I hadn't thought about that too much, but that could, like, as I say, the winglets could definitely be one of the big reasons.
Yeah. So, you know, something to see that, and of course, I'm sure when it rains, we'll see all those Ducatis right to the front as we normally do.
Yeah.
But
so, yeah, that was a pretty good weekend in Le Mans for the racing action. Of course, we have Donington Park this weekend for World Superbikes, and then we have the Mugello Barcelona back to back rounds coming up after that. So it's it's
before a great time for racing. Man. We also have the Isle of Man starting up too.
We do also have the Isle of Man TT starting up. I believe practice starts probably 2 days after this episode goes up. And then there will be racing. We'll try and do some coverage of the TT this year. We were sort of pretty light on it last year. Obviously, with Mugello and Barcelona going on at the same time, it can be tricky. But the TT will be starting. Of course, John McGuinness not there after his crash at the Northwest. His electric bike will now be ridden by Bruce Anstey, and his Supersport bike will be ridden by Josh Brooks. Josh Brooks also competing in the lightweight TT. So good to see Brooksy back at the TT, and good to see him get a variety of rides as well. And I think especially maybe in that lightweight class, we could see Brooksy up there challenging for victory.
Yeah, no, he was kind of a surprise that he was able to do so well when he came over, and just goes to show that guy's got the natural talent to ride. You give him the right bike, he's going to go fast. Now, he may not be going fast on every bike, but as we saw with that Yamaha, you know, it'd be tough to say that anybody on any given machine was going to stop him in the BSB last year.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, there's a lot of racing happening. And, of course, you know, Nicky Hayden will continue to be in all of our minds. And I'm sure that we'll see, you know, a number of custom helmets and, you know, tributes to Nicky from all the races out there. You know, there's a hashtag, I believe it's hashtag 69 seconds of noise, to, you know, hopefully have Nicky Hayden remembered by, you know, much like they did for Marco Simoncelli at Valencia, by having 69 seconds of noise during the Mugello weekend. And I'm sure that World Superbikes will be doing something for Hayden at Donington Park as well. So Nicky will, you know, definitely be in all of our thoughts, you know, not just this race, but at all races, and, you know, probably for a very long time after this. So hopefully we can have another great weekend of racing at Donington Park, and then also at Mugello to remember Nicky Hayden, because, you know, as we said, if there was one guy who'd want to be remembered with a good race, it's certainly Nicky Hayden, you know, who just loved breathed, and slept, you know, racing. Everything was about racing to him and the family. So hopefully, you know, we can remember him in the best way possible.
Yeah, he got to do the rare thing, is that he got to live out his dream of becoming a champion rider. That was what he wanted to do since he was little. And I don't know about you, but I still don't have my Superman cape, so I haven't fulfilled my dream as a child. But you know, and before we go, I'd also like to send our condolences out and to all those affected by what happened in Manchester this week. That was also another huge thing to wake up to and see, and just another shit act upon, you know, innocent people that doesn't need to happen. Doesn't, you know, people don't deserve that. And it's hopefully everybody out there in Manchester, and I know Britain's still on alert because they're still worried about another attack. Everyone stay safe. Be vigil, watch out for everything, and, you know, just continue to enjoy what we have while we have it.
Exactly. You know, that is a pretty great thing about racing, is that, you know, it can often offer us a bit of a break from a world that's, you know, not really the best at times. So, as we said, hopefully we'll have some great racing to talk about and, you know, distract us and, you know, allow us to smile at least a little bit. Hopefully this episode of Motopod has made everybody smile. Thank you for joining Skylar, myself, and then the other hosts with their tributes to Nicky. And yeah, remember, in the words of Nicky Hayden, you know, let's get it. Let's keep pushing. And yeah, we'll catch you all hopefully next week. And if not, the week after that.
Yep. Let's get it.